Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
This afternoon. Hope you're having a good day. I most certainly am. Nice to be with you today. If you should decide to join the program, you may do so at 866-546-5254. We'd love to have you join us on the program today. That's always a treat for me to hear from you. And I tune in every day so that I can hear from you. And you tune in so you can hear from me. So let's just go back and forth. Had some great calls yesterday. Hope to do that as well today. Lots to talk about today. We've got a terrific guest coming up at the bottom of this hour. We have Paul Ehrlich, who was the author clear back in 1968 of a book called The Population Bomb, which stirred up a lot of controversy back in those days. He's got a new one out called The Dominant Animal, Human Evolution and the Environment by he and his wife, Paul Ehrlich and Ann Ehrlich, and you will enjoy hearing from him, and we promise that will be a very interesting interview coming up at the bottom of the hour. So we look forward to that today. Lots to talk about today. Don't know where to start, really. There's so much going on. Washington's kind of dead right now, what with the recess coming up and all that. I see Karl Rove, the Judiciary Committee anyway, today voted to cite him for contempt of Congress. We shall see if anything comes of it. We shall see if Nancy Pelosi decides to put the old kibosh to that, which she may well. She doesn't seem to be in the mood to want to do anything to any of the criminals in the Bush administration. Nancy, what's wrong? Did you see Nancy on TV with John, what's his name? I thought her whole interview was somewhat incoherent and just not, I don't know. It was kind of wacky. I wonder what you think about it. Anyway, I'm I'm not sure I like the direction Nancy Pelosi's taking. Well, let me clear that up. Somebody looked at me funny. I'm not sure. I shouldn't say it that way. I don't like the direction she's taken the United States Congress. I don't like it at all, the House. It's been a mess. She hasn't been a good Speaker of the House. I was hoping for a lot more from Nancy Pelosi, frankly. And I think, well, frankly, she's not my favorite politician. I had high hopes for her, but she's just not getting the job done. John McCain running a respectful and clean campaign. That was their motto. And, you know, I looked at that somewhat with a jaundiced eye when they first came out and said that they're going to run a clean, respectful campaign, because we all know what kind of campaign the Republicans have run over the past couple of decades. They've been dirty, rotten, filthy campaigns down in the gutter. And I had no reason to think that they wouldn't resort to that once again, the Swift voters and all of that. So here they are again. Once again, they're back. Respectful and clean campaign. Let me give you the titles off some of the campaign buttons being sold outside of McCain's town hall meeting in Reno, Nevada. Okay? These buttons being hawked outside of his campaign town hall meeting in Reno, Nevada. And here's the title of some of the buttons. Big, you know, the big round campaign buttons. Spell check. Says Obama is Osama. Join the Communist Party. Vote Obama. Comrade Barack Obama. Obama the most popular candidate in the Middle East. Love high gas prices? Obama did it. Want more taxes? Vote Obama. Want more 9/11s? Vote Obama. Fear taxes? Again and again and again, they run on fear. They run on taxes. They're now running an ad comparing Obama with Paris Hilton and Britney Spears. Have you heard that one? Let me play it for you. This is the New Republican ad, the respectful and clean campaign, complaining now about Obama's celebrity. This is a New Republican campaign ad.
He's the biggest celebrity in the world. But is he ready to lead? With gas prices soaring, Barack Obama says no to offshore drilling and says he'll raise taxes on electricity. Higher taxes, more foreign oil. That's the real Obama.
I'm John McCain, and I approve this message.
I'm John McCain, and I approve this message. Of course, they had the pictures of Hillary or Paris Hilton and what's her name? What's the other one? Paris Hilton and Britney Spears had the pictures of that intertwined with that ad. And so that one with the Obama didn't want to visit the injured troops ad that they were running. Both of these, if you notice, are being run by the McCain campaign, not by any 527s. They both say, I'm John McCain and I approve this ad on the end of it. John McCain, as we predicted, has abandoned any idea that he might run a respectful and a decent and a clean campaign, and John McCain is a liar. John McCain, let's just cut through the crap. Let's tell it like it is. I'm not going to treat him with kid gloves. He may be a war hero and all that, and you know my opinion on that. John McCain is a liar. John McCain, this is the man who's pontificating about Barack Obama. He doesn't say much about himself because he can't say much of himself. The guy is a crook. First of all, he's a crook. Don't forget that this is the same John McCain that was involved in the Keating Five. Let's not forget that. Let's never forget that. This is the same John McCain whose son now, Andrew K. McCain, has resigned as the chairman of the board of directors of Silver State Bank Corp. We don't know why. He's on the board of a couple of banks. What is it about the Bushes and the McCains having their fingers in the SNLs and the banks? What is it about that? John McCain himself had his fingerprints all over the Keating savings and loan thing. He was a crook way back then. He's still a crook. Once you're a politician and you're taking the quid pro quo money, you're done. You're done as far as I'm concerned. And yet somehow John McCain has rebuilt his reputation and here he is running as president for the presidency of the United States. I, for one, don't understand that. I don't understand why the people of Arizona would have put him back in office at a hint of scandal, with even the slightest hint of a scandal like he had back during this sordid affair with the Keating Five. Why is it we've forgotten all about that? Why is it that the press of today, the mainstream media, isn't mentioning that whatsoever? Why can that be? And then he comes out with these low-down lying ads. I guess they thought the one about comparing him to Paris Hilton and Britney Spears is funny. Ha, ha, ha. I guess the one that they're telling the lies about how he wouldn't visit the troops because he couldn't take the photographers in with him. That is a huge lie. This is John McCain saying this. This is John McCain cutting down Barack Obama because he doesn't treat the troops right. This is the same John McCain who's voted against one bill after another to take better care of our troops. With more money, with safety equipment, with more medical care. This is the same John McCain hiding behind, oh, I'm a war hero. Yeah, well, he's gotten good care. He's gotten a good retirement pay over his years. But anything for the new veterans, screw them. That's been his attitude. You don't see that advertised now, do you? You don't see the mainstream media bringing that up at 24/7, do you? It's a fact. John McCain waves the flag. John McCain says, oh, I'm for the troops. I'm for the troops. You tell me what he's done for the troops except put them in harm's way. I'm sick of hearing about it. John McCain is a liar. His whole campaign is a lie. When I looked at the field of these Republican candidates that were running for the presidency, I said, what a bunch of losers. Never did I dream that John McCain, one of the biggest losers of all, would float to the top out of that group. But I'm sick of it. The mainstream media doesn't lay a glove on him. Finally, Andrea Mitchell comes out and says, hey, you guys aren't telling the truth, although she wouldn't say the word lie. She was there. She was there when Obama chose not to go in with his people into the see the wounded troops. She knew what happened. She said so. One of the few that would tell what the truth is. And yet, where's the mainstream media on this? Where are they? They have completely dropped the ball. John McCain is a liar. This crap of him refusing to meet with the wounded soldiers in Germany. Not one solitary shred of evidence to back up that claim. Nothing. Nothing. Not one piece of evidence. And they just threw it out there, and the mainstream media took off and ran with it. The Limbaughs and the Hannitys and that ilk just took off and ran with it. No facts behind it whatsoever. Nothing. And I defy a single one of you or anybody to come up with any facts that would sustain their argument that he refused to go in and visit the troops because he wasn't going to get a good photo out of it. I defy anybody to come up with one shred of evidence to say that. You know why? Because there isn't any evidence to support that. None whatsoever. How many days now? The Washington Post had a story in today. Who wrote that? Michael Shear and Dan Baltz. Said for 4 days, John McCain and his allies have accused Senator Barack Obama of snubbing wounded soldiers by canceling a visit to a military hospital because he couldn't take the reporters with him despite no evidence that the charge is true. Finally, after how many days now, this comes out in the Washington Post. They go on to say the attacks are part of a newly aggressive McCain operation whose aim is to portray the Democratic presidential candidate as a craven politician more interested in his image than in ailing soldiers, a senior McCain advisor said. They come despite repeated pledges by the Republican that he will never question his rival's patriotism. Really? Oh, really, John McCain? You would not question Barack Obama's patriotism, and yet you accuse him of not going to see wounded soldiers because he couldn't get a photo op out of it? That's not questioning his patriotism? That's not even the worst part. The challenge has been put to him to provide some evidence for this. And they brought out nothing. Nothing. You know that all you have to do is feed this to the right-wing talking heads, and they will spread it around the country, and it becomes truth. The same as we've always said on this program, like Rush Limbaugh does on a Monday, he'll get a caller, and then when it's all done, a guy gives him a big line of bullshit, and then at the end of the call, Rush Limbaugh will say, well, we know. We just whatever the caller said, whatever it is, if it's some lame, cockamamie idea that Limbaugh thinks he can get some mileage of it, he'll say, well, we know what the caller just said. We know it to be true. We know that, and it becomes truth all of a sudden to these people. It becomes truth to 20 million listeners. How does that happen, that people listen to propaganda? And I know this has happened over the ages, ever since radio, ever since people got up and spoke in public, no doubt. Back in the Roman and the Greek times. Somebody get up and speaks to a crowd, tell them a big fat-ass lie, and the next thing you know, it's spread all over the neighborhood as the truth. What does that say for the human intellect? What does that say for the capacity of people to think and come up with their own ideas and their own conclusions about something? What does it say? Personally, I have a hard time taking anything at face value from anybody unless my brain processes it and say, well, this person has complete credibility. This person has proven to me that they never lie. This person has proven to me that they never stretch the truth. This person has proven to me that they've done the adequate research for what they have to say. Therefore, when I put that information into my brain, I know I can pretty well trust it. Not saying that I wouldn't check it out myself, because I usually do. But how can it be that the masses sit and listen to this horse crap coming out of the McCain campaign, and it becomes truth? All over America today, there are millions of people who said, you know that Obama? He didn't go visit those wounded troops. Now, that no good? Why? Isn't that just like a Democrat? Isn't that just like a liberal? How can it be? How can it be that so many people are so damn stupid and so lazy, intellectually lazy, that they don't check things out? McCain's campaign released a statement from retired Sergeant Major Craig Layton, who worked as a commander at the hospital, who said, if Senator Obama isn't comfortable meeting wounded American troops without his entourage, perhaps he does not have the experience necessary to serve as commander-in-chief. McCain's advisor said they don't intend to back down from the charge, believing it an effective way to create a narrative about what they say is Obama's indifference toward the military. McCain spokesman Tucker Bounds said again yesterday that the Republicans' version of events is correct, and that Obama canceled the visit because he was not allowed to take reporters and cameras into the hospital. They went on to say, the McCain campaign did, it is safe to say that according to press reports, Barack Obama avoided, skipped, canceled the visit because of those reasons. We're not making a leap here. Asking repeatedly for the reports that he quoted, Bounds provided three examples, none of which alleged that Obama had wanted to take members of the media to the hospital. None of which said that he intended to take members of the media to the hospital. No proof at all. But they throw it at the wall and see if it'll stick, and with the mainstream media, the pathetic mainstream media we have today, just a little protestation here and there from people saying, oh, maybe that's not true. But it's a load of crap made up out of whole cloth to show that Obama's not a patriot. And doesn't this sound familiar? Doesn't this just sound so familiar to you? You remember Max Cleland? You remember Max Cleland? I've met Max Cleland. I've seen what's left of Max Cleland's body. It is. It makes me so sad that anybody could have done the things in a campaign against Max Cleland that Saxby Chambliss and the Republican Party did to Max Cleland, a man that left a good bit of his body on the battlefield, fighting for this country. But once again, nothing is sacred to these Republicans. They did it to Max Cleland, they did it to John Kerry, they did it to Al Gore, they'll do it to anybody that stands in their way. I don't want to hear anything about patriotism from these people. I don't want them from their self-made ivory towers looking down at the rest of us and saying that we're not patriots. Looking down at the likes of an Obama, a Max Cleland, a John Kerry, and Al Gore, no matter who we would run. From their supposed perches as military heroes and so forth. I don't want to hear it. Because it's just flat and not true. I'm sick of the John McCain war hero thing. I'm sick of it. I have mentioned on this show many times that I honor him for his service. I've mentioned this. I have mentioned that he, no doubt, had bravery in what he went through. But in no way whatsoever does that qualify you to be the President of the United States. Nothing in that regard qualified you to be the President of the United States. I'm sick of John McCain saying, well, I don't want to use that. And he said that, I've heard him say it 100 times. I don't want to use that as, a means of getting to the White House. Yes, I was in the military, but I'm not going to use that. He ends every speech with it. And the moral of the story is, John McCain, hero, patriot, Barack Obama, low-down Muslim, anti-American commie. That's the message that they're putting out. I have seen no evidence whatsoever. None. That Barack Obama is not a patriot of the highest order. I have seen no evidence that he doesn't take good care of his family. I have seen no evidence that he's not a good, faithful man to his religion. I've seen no evidence that he's not a great American. I've seen no evidence that he wasn't a fine teacher in college when he taught law. I have seen no evidence that he wasn't a good community organizer. I have seen damn little, if anything, to say that Barack Obama is not a fine, upstanding patriot in this country and that he doesn't love this country. So John McCain and your Republican thugs, you can take your propaganda crap and stick it where the sun doesn't shine, because I'm not buying it, and any thinking American won't buy it either. It just makes me sick. I didn't intend to talk about that today. This latest ad just put me over the edge. I'm telling you, I warned everybody that this was coming. We knew it was coming. I guess we should cool our jets a bit, because we know damn well it's going to get worse. It's going to get a lot worse. They are the rats in the corner. They'll accuse him of being anti-patriotic. They'll accuse him of being a Muslim. They'll use racism on him. They'll use anything. They'll use any tactic that Lee Atwater ever came up with and more. And if you think Karl Rove isn't behind the scenes on some of this, if you think Karl Rove a few weeks ago didn't say to these guys, hey, you got to get roll up your sleeves and get down in the dirt, boys. Because that's where this McCain campaign has gone. And that's where they intend to go. because they know that's where they have to go. Other than that, they've got nothing. They've got nothing. They've got a man who says he knows how to win wars. We've talked about that. Tell us about these wars we've won, John. I did hear him claim the other day that we've won the Iraq War. You might get a class of kindergartners to accept that. I don't know. I doubt it. Look, I don't have a problem with a guy going out and bragging himself up. I don't have a problem with a guy stretching his resume to the limit. But there comes a time when you have to frame your campaign in reality. There comes a time when you have to decide whether or not you're going to be a man or a goddamn liar. And John McCain has decided to take the low road in this campaign. And frankly, several years ago, I thought a lot more highly of John McCain than that. I did. Maybe 6 months ago, I didn't like his politics, but I thought maybe a little higher of him than that. But now that the mask has been pulled back, now that he's desperate to be president of the United States, now that he's shown that he will do anything, to gain the presidency, I've lost all respect for John McCain. Did you notice how his donations have gone up from the big oil companies since he decided to change his mind and go for drilling offshore? Did you see that? Of course, there's no quid pro quo involved there now, is there? No. So, John McCain, you can throw out all the crap you want to about Barack Obama, and maybe the Democrats mostly will sit by and take it, but we will not on this program. We watched Al Gore take it. We watched John Kerry take it. And we will not sit by silently and listen to Barack Obama take it. If nobody else speaks up in a forceful way, we will. That I can promise you. Well, that's probably not the last thing I have to say about John McCain today. That's something else I was going to talk about in a minute or two. We're going to have our guest with us in just a couple of minutes while I pour some ice water over my head and cool down just a little bit. I'm absolutely furious over these McCain people. I don't know. I probably had a hint, just a smidgen of hope a few months ago that maybe McCain meant what he said and he was just going to run a good old-fashioned issues campaign. But then I came to my senses and, guy, come on. You know that's not going to happen. He's a Republican. They don't know how to run a clean campaign. Got no idea. If you don't believe that, ask Mike Dukakis. Yeah. Ask Mike Dukakis about clean campaigns. Sure. Well, we are going to pause for a break right now, and we shall be back in just a moment or two, so don't go away.
Here's the guy changing the way you hear music, Billy Shears. Changing the way you hear music, Billy Shears.
Midnight Sounds every Saturday night, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern. You'll hear the latest in new music releases, special segments like One Hit Wonders, Under the Covers, and Night Sounds dedications with the sassy and classy Erica Richards. For requests and dedications, direct your email to nightsounds@billyshearsmusic.com. So tune in and stop by the chat room this Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Thanks for lending an ear.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Guy James Show. And I won't string you along with a big, long introduction. We did that a little bit before, and we'll talk about it a little bit more. But it is my honor and my pleasure right now to have a gentleman by the name of Paul Ehrlich with us. He is, he and his wife wrote the new book, The Dominant Animal, Human Evolution and the Environment, which is it's if ever a book was too interesting, this one probably is. And he wrote The Population Bomb, which many of you are familiar with back in 1968, I believe it was. And Paul, I'd like to welcome you to the program.
Great to be there.
You're currently at Stanford?
Yeah, I've been here for 49 years. I'm one of the old-time faculty members.
Well, it's a school with a pretty fair repute, I would say.
Yeah, got a good climate, too.
Yes, you do. Palo Alto, right?
It's burning right now, though, all over California.
Have you got smoke in? You got smoke in your?
We haven't. We haven't the last couple of days. It varies, but in the Sierra, it's pretty bad. We've had a very dry year. I guess you guys have got a little wetter again down there, have you?
Well, just recently, we were very, very dry up until a month ago, and then we started getting, for some reason, some really odd rainfall. But
it's good you get it.
Yeah, we don't like the fires either. We get them here.
Yeah, I know.
You've come up with I tell you, I started through this book. I get a lot of books from publishers, and some of them, you know, you start into, and I always give people 50 pages. If the book isn't grabbing me and holding me in 50 pages, why then I'm low. I just put it down usually. This one's a keeper all the way through, and because it's so germane to the conversation that's going on amongst so many people right now about the future of this planet and where we are. And you're known for sticking your neck out. In your Population Bomb book, you made some predictions about what may happen in the future. Some of them are right, some of them are wrong, but that's kind of the way science goes, isn't it?
Yeah. If I wrote a book 40 years ago in science and it was still, I would write the same book today, then it would be a pretty slow science. But one of the mistakes I made in the book was putting in a series of little scenarios, which I described as stories about the future that aren't going to come true but might help you think about it. And, of course, they all got translated into predictions immediately. But, again, mixed record on the book was too optimistic in most ways but a little too pessimistic in some others.
Well, that's science. Indeed. That's how it is. If you had been right on all counts in that book, I'd be begging you to go to Las Vegas with me.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. If I could really predict the future, I would have bought a lot of stocks low, sold them high, and bought the island of Bora Bora, and you wouldn't be talking to me now.
I'd want to be somewhere close in the neighborhood, too.
No, I might save a place for you.
Paul, why do you think the way that the way we've evolved as a species, we humans, has impacted the environment?
Well, I think what we have been is extremely successful. In other words, our genetic evolution laid the groundwork for us being able to have the brains to develop a vast culture. I mean, we have huge amounts of non-genetic information that we've accumulated and stored in places like books, libraries, the structure of 747s, and so on, and that has given us the power to basically take over the planet. And so we're a very smart and very successful species by biological standards, and I think by most of our own standards, too.
But our success in our evolution is leading to our demise, is it not?
Yeah, well, that's the problem. We have one of the things that's happened in our cultural evolution is that we have evolved extremely rapidly in the technological areas. I mean, imagine that somehow we all disappeared 100 years from now and 1,000 years from now, a Martian archaeologist came down to Earth and excavated, say, New York from 2000 and or 2008 and, say, London from 1500. And you would think from the artifacts, from what remains, that it was two entirely different species, maybe in two entirely different families of mammals that did it. Our technological change since the 1500 has been absolutely extraordinary. On the other hand, if you think about our ethics, a lot of the problems that worry ethicists today and worry us also worried people like Plato thousands of years ago. So in the ethical area, our evolution has been very much slower than our technological evolution. And in some sense, we've given an idiot child a machine gun. Human beings are, in terms of mammal species, we're really adolescents, and we've been given a gigantic amount of power, and we've sure got to learn fast how to use it before we use it to kill ourselves off.
And yet, so many people, especially in leadership around the world, fails to recognize.
Well, that's among other things, that's a problem of our educational system. People, mostly don't get the background in human evolution, in behavior, and how the environment works. I mean, look how easy it's been for a little bit of money and some hired naysayers to insert all kinds of uncertainty about climate change, when in fact, as science goes, there's very little uncertainty about the basic things. There's a lot of uncertainty about details, but we've known for 100 years that if you added certain things to the atmosphere, you're going to change the climate. That's not new news. What's new is we found about another equivalent to the CO2 that's being added to the atmosphere, so that concerns I had 40 years ago about climate change towards the end of this century have been moved forward to the beginning of this century, because 40 years ago we didn't know about the effects of nitrous oxide and methane and so on the climate.
I see the Chinese are recognizing that in a big way this particular week, and as the Olympics comes up, I've seen the pictures of Beijing. It's not a pretty sight right now.
No, it's not a pretty sight, but the Chinese have been way, way ahead of our government in trying to deal with the climate issue. I mean, they have official government documents that point out, for example, something that you never hear from the mass media in the U.S., namely that the more people you have, the more greenhouse gases you put into the atmosphere, and the more rapidly the climate upon which we're utterly dependent for our food is going to change.
Well, here we are, and we talk a lot about politics on this program. That's the essence of this program.
Is there something politically going on in this country?
Well,
the world's longest election, maybe?
I'm so weary of it. But I find it bizarre that here we are in a presidential election year, and we're talking about issues such as whether or not gays can get married in California, when the environmental impact of really important decisions we've made are destroying the planet on which we live, and hardly anybody's talking about it. It's fascinating.
It's horrifying to me and my colleagues. That's one of the reasons we wrote The Dominant Animal. I mean, we'd like to get this back into the general discussion. We can all survive for millions of years whether or not gays get married, but we can't survive for millions of years, at least as a civilization, kind of civilization we have now, if we wreck our life support systems, and that's what we're very busily doing. And some of the debate, has both the economists I know and the ecologists just desperate. For instance, I was asked by a reporter, should we be drilling for oil in a pristine place like like Anwar, National Wildlife Refuge in Australia, in Alaska? And I said, frankly, I don't care whether Anwar is pristine or a wasteland. We shouldn't be drilling for oil anywhere. We have found more than enough oil to destroy our civilization. What we have to do is get going and move off of oil and coal and natural gas for our energy, or we're going to be very hungry, among other things. And, of course, in Florida, I think you'll still be on dry land, but you'll probably be beachfront there.
I'm pretty close to the coast.
Did you look at the map? Did you look at the map?
Yes.
Dominant Animal, which shows what Florida will look like.
Yes, I did, Paul, and I'll tell you, I'd be standing up to my waist in water right now.
Actually, the food problems will be worse. I sort of guarantee people, unless we're very, very unlucky, you'll be able to outwalk sea level rise.
Yes.
But food's another issue.
A lot of this, of course, we place at the foot of the population boom that's going on. And I thought in our country, at least, we had it fairly well under control. And I've tried to trace back and back and back, and I could be dead wrong. But according to any research I've done, I think that I can trace this back, being a political guy that I am, maybe to the beginning of the Reagan administration, when first of all, they did away with a lot of environmental progress that we'd made, and then that led to a new population boom because of the conservative movement's anti-abortion stance. And hadn't we reached a zero population growth plateau in this country right before that?
We were very close back then, but of course the Mexico City policy put in by the Reagan administration and pursued now by the Bush administration basically is a policy for murdering women. In other words, it prevents abortions around the world and limits access to contraception. But what you have to remember is, like it or not, when you make abortion illegal, you don't change the rate of abortion, you just change the rate at which women die from being aborted. So it's an absolutely horrible policy. I think all of us would like to get rid of abortion, but we don't want to have a lot of women dying. So that was one thing. And, of course, the whole talk about population became a taboo in the Reagan days. Just like, I mean, if you want to destroy the environment, which that administration and the Bush administration clearly wanted to do for fun and profit, then one of the best ways to do it is keep adding people to the population. We have 304 million people in the United States now. We're the third most populous nation in the world. And nobody's ever come up with even a semi-sane reason for why we ought to have more than 140 million people at once. Now, down there, you may have no congestion, but out here, let me tell you.
We've got plenty. And yet there is no discussion of this going on in this country.
No, it's appalling. The scientific community, by the way, has spoken out repeatedly on this. In 1993, both the World Scientist Warning to Humanity, which was signed by more than half of the living Nobel laureates and about 1,500 of the other leading scientists in the world, and a statement from all the science academies of the world, 58 of them, all saying if we keep the population growing and keep each person consuming ever more, we're basically going to wreck our civilization. No major media paid any attention to it. You know, scientific community says if we stay on the course we're on now, we're in deep, deep trouble. Not even news.
I wonder how many people, and if there have been any studies done on how many people that this world, this planet can have and still sustain a decent quality of life for everybody. But then I think about everybody. Half the world doesn't have a decent quality of life right now.
Right. Well, you put the kicker in. When people say how many people can the world support, it depends on whether you want a world like what my colleague Gretchen Daly calls a battery chicken world, in which, say, we manage to support 9 or 10 billion people, each one with a minimum of space, eating the simplest mush diet and having, you know, no consumption basically beyond keeping their shelf, a roof over their head and food in their stomachs. Or do you want a world like I would prefer, where people have a maximum of options, a world which has big cities so you can have operas, symphonies, fine restaurants, baseball teams, and so on, but other people could live like hermits? And it turns out that probably for what we know at the moment, the latter size would be between 1.5 and 2 billion people, which is just about the number there was when I was born. When I and I were born, there were 2 billion people. When the population bomb was written, there were 3.5 billion people. And 40 years later, there's 6.7 billion people. That means we've added more people since we wrote that silly book than existed when we were born.
Amazing. I think back when I was in high school, there were 160 million people in the country, and now 304. What a dramatic growth.
Growing like a skyrocket.
It is, in fact. We went past 250 and didn't even look at it, and I was amazed when the 300 creeped up on us the way it did. That brings me back to your book, The Population Bomb. You had made a prediction in there that the population would go down, that there would be enough people die for one reason or another through famine and whatnot to take the population downward. But that's one place where you're off the mark.
No, off the mark there, certainly globally, not locally. I mean, we've had population declines in parts of Africa and Russia and so on, but blessedly. In other words, one of the reasons for writing the population bomb was to try and get the issue out there and try and get people to do things that would prevent what we used to call a death rate solution. I mean, there's no question that the population explosion is going to end. It's either going to end because we limit our reproduction, or it's going to end because the death rate goes up. And my ethical, not scientific position is we ought to try and not let the death rate go up. And so I'm very pleased that we've gone that far. But of course, ecologists tend to take the long view. One of the main reasons that the death rate didn't go up is that, first of all, the Green Revolution was temporarily successful in South Asia, where there was a lot of concern about famine. And society responding to population growth did find ways to move food around so that massive local famines became much rarer, although we still have been losing between 5 and 10 million people a year to hunger and hunger-related disease. But I'm very pleased that that prediction was wrong. But if you've been watching the papers and recently, you'll see all the stuff about how the Green Revolution in India is collapsing, reasons that we predicted way back when. And, of course, climate change is having starting to have an impact there. We have now less grain than we would have had if we hadn't had the temperature rises, and wheat and rice in South Asia are being grown within a degree or so of their upper limits for present strains. That is the temperature at which they can grow, and the glaciers of Central Asia are melting, and they're what supply the agricultural water to South Asia and much of China. So the situation is not it does not look rosy, let's put it that way.
Yeah, a lot of people don't think about the point you just brought up about the glaciers and mountaintop waters and so forth. There are many places around the world where water supplies for millions and millions of people come from glaciers and high-altitude snow and so forth that we're not getting anymore.
I'm living in one of those places. California depends. I mean, obviously, the same amount of water can come down as rain or snow, but if it comes down as rain and is not frozen during the winter, it just runs off before the farm fields can use it. So the storage in snow and glaciers is incredibly important. And right here in California, we're facing, well, part of the state's burning right now. We had a very dry year, record low snowpack, and we're the biggest ag state in the union. So if we start losing our agricultural water, it's going to hurt everybody in the pocketbook at least, and hopefully not in the stomach.
And yet we have people wanting to excavate half of the West in order to cook oil out of underground deposits and divert a huge amount of water from the Colorado River, at least. I don't think a lot of people understand how much water it takes to do that process.
That's right. Well, and not only that, the amount of carbon dioxide you put into the atmosphere is even bigger than you do get from burning oil and coal, or standard oil and coal, and that's what we've got to stop doing. I mean, you know, the climatologists are really worried that we're going to go past the tipping point. The chief climatologist for the government, Jim Hansen, says we got to get back below today's concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the other greenhouse gases, and we're still moving up. In other words, not a sensible move has been made yet to limit the flow of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, even though our agriculture is utterly dependent on the distribution of water, and we've almost certainly changed precipitation patterns to the degree that they will continue to change for almost a millennium, even if we get the CO2 back down over the next several decades.
Where do you think is
the cost, by the way, of changing all your dams, your pipes, all your stuff for handling water? What is a city like Lima with millions of people going to do when its glacier has melted?
Exactly. Exactly. They're not going to be trucking water into a city that size.
Sure aren't.
What do you think is an optimum level of population in this world that we can sustain in a decent style? Where would you think it would that level?
I would think about the number when I was born, about 2 billion people. We have to be. We often say 1.5 to 2 billion, and the reason is we'd like to leave a little leeway for surprises. A classic example of surprise was the pure luck that we had that Sherry Rowland got interested in what was happening to the chlorofluorocarbons, you know, the freons, mm-hmm. that were originally thought to be a miracle because they replaced poisonous working fluids in our refrigerators. You know, DuPont took on the motto, better things for better living, for chemistry, because it saved lives. lives by inventing freons and having them in our refrigerators and our air conditioners. And as you may recall, it almost destroyed the ozone layer. If the ozone layer had been destroyed, then the scuba manufacturers would have been temporarily rich because we couldn't have any life on land. We'd all have had to retreat under the oceans, which would have been an interesting exercise. So we'd like to have the flexibility to have some safety margin in our numbers, and that's why I usually say 1.5 to 2 billion people. Now look, I could be dead wrong. It may be the technological change will allow us in the future to happily support, say, 4 billion, or it might be 0.5 billion would be safer. And the point is that if we're going to get there humanely, we got about 100 years. In other words, we're going to top off our, if we're lucky and we don't have a huge die-off and people do continue to change their reproductive habits, it'll be around the end of the century when we level off somewhere around 9, maybe 10 billion people, and then start declining. And we'll have many decades to decide whether Ehrlich's estimate of 1.5 to 2 billion is a proper one or whether there are reasons to revise it up or down. We don't have to decide today what the optimum population is. Every single scientist I know is convinced that it's below where we are today by substantial.
Well, and the thing is, it seems to me that the population explosion will end either by choice or by another means, which seems far less acceptable to mankind. It's going to be pay me now or pay me later.
I'm particularly afraid that a lot of hunger, a lot more disease, and nuclear weapons are going to prove to be a very unhappy mix if we're not careful.
Well, by what means, if you say it may take 100 years to reach an optimum level, how long will it take, would it take, given that we put procedures in place and policies in place and the ethics involved that we need in place, to take the population back down to where you think is an acceptable, sustainable level?
Well, I think it would probably take about 100 years if we didn't have an emergency, if we did it. I mean, you would like to do it gradually for obvious reasons. For instance, if you could get it down very fast, if you said, okay, nobody's going to have any children for 20 years, but you'd immediately wipe out the school systems and the baby food industry and so on and so forth. Then when you started getting babies again, you'd have to reestablish them. So doing this smoothly is going to cause less economic and social disruption, and you could probably do it with essentially none, whereas doing it with dramatic steps can cause all kinds of problems. The Chinese, in the population bomb period, we were saying if you wait till government come up with solutions, they'll often be very bad solutions. Well, the Chinese suddenly saw how desperate they were. They had a census and had a lot more people than they expected, and so they installed the one-child family system. And although it's been very effective in lowering their birth rates, it's caused all kinds of social disruption with their minorities. There are problems now with there being many, many more boy babies than girl babies because they introduced ultrasound all over the country, and although it's illegal, women get ultrasound, and if they are carrying a girl, they'll very often abort it, much more often than if it's a boy. So it's much better to do these things with planning and over the long term, but of course things are getting desperate at a very high rate. And, should we eventually get a president who has more than a room temperature IQ, he might actually propose some things that would probably not be in the best in desperation.
Yeah, we're either going to do it by choice or have somebody force it upon us. And in China, actually, that was the law, wasn't it? It was decreed.
Yeah, it was decreed. You got to remember, though, that the Chinese are much more towards the social responsibility end of the scale than Americans, who are at the individual liberty end of the scale. So that programs in China that look awful to us were not as awful to most of the Chinese. Ann and I met secretly about 15 years ago with about 20 professional women in China. What we wanted to know was what their attitude was on the one-child family program. And it took them about 2 minutes to say, it's absolutely necessary, we're totally in favor of it, we've got to do it. And then one of them said, I'm an excellent neurosurgeon, but I will never be the head of my service because that has to be a man. And we listened for 2 hours to stories of the glass ceiling. In other words, the prejudice against women was still very strong in China, but the Chinese women were fully in favor of the one child, the educated women, of the one-child family thing. So it's a complex thing, and I'd love to avoid it in the United States by just getting a government that says, look, we can't debate immigration policy if we don't know how many people we want to have in the country. It's like asking an airplane designer to design you an airplane that'll load 50 people a minute. And when he says, how many will it fly with? You say, don't worry about that. Just build me one that'll load 50 minutes, people a minute. You can't have an immigration debate without having a population policy, and we don't have one.
Amazing that one of those is a hot issue and the other is completely unheard of. Other than talking to a few scientists, I don't know. Do you know Al Gore?
Not well, but I've known him. He was the only senator who came to our nuclear winter hearings when Carl Sagan and Peter Raven and John Holdren and I and a bunch of other scientists were working on the nuclear winter issue, Steve Schneider and so on. And most of the senators sent aides, but Al sent Kane himself and got to know him some then and subsequently. Have you heard of his new plan for converting away from fossil fuels for electricity over the next 10 years?
Yes, that is a challenge.
Well, it is a challenge, and I have two views of it. One is he's absolutely right. In other words, we could do it. The downside is it would take the kind of mobilization we had for the Second World War to accomplish it. In other words, that can't be done with little bits of this here and there. We would have to decide that that's the major goal for the country, just like beating the Germans, Italians, and Japanese was turned into a major goal on September 7th, 1941, which I remember very clearly. And, you know, at that time, we were producing, I guess, hundreds of thousands of cars a year, and a year later, we were producing hundreds of thousands of airplanes. I mean, we really, everybody got involved. I was 9 years old, and one of my jobs was to turn out the street light in front of our house in New Jersey. And you know how I did that? I had to get a ladder and put it up against the pole, and then I climbed up the ladder, and I grabbed the wire loop and pulled it down, and that turned off the gas to the streetlight. That'll show you how long ago it was.
And I'll bet you at 9 years old, you felt really important doing that.
I felt that I was doing my bit. We went out, we collected milkweed pods so that the cake pop in life vests. We saved aluminum foil. Everybody had gasoline rationing. Of course, there were some profiteers and so on, but basically everybody got involved. Everybody knew somebody who was in the service. Most people knew people who were killed in the service, and it was a total mobilization. But again, in the end of 1945, we switched back, stopped making airplanes, and started making automobiles again. I mean, so you're talking 5-6 years there, and we had two transformations of our economy. So if we wanted to do what Al says, and I think it'd be a wonderful thing to do, we could do it. But the issue isn't – I'm very optimistic about what we could do with a lot of these things. I tend to be very pessimistic about what we will do.
It's just hard to – yes.
Well – we are fighting a war, killing lots of American kids, killing even more Iraqis. And what are we fighting it over? We're fighting it over oil, a resource we shouldn't be after and shouldn't be burning. In other words, it's absolutely not sure. It's true that our government didn't have anybody in it who knew the difference between a Shia or a Sunni or a Kurd. I mean, it was a totally ignorant thing to do to try and get the oil that way. But even the idea of getting the oil, and you haven't heard much about this, the New York Times, which urged us to get into the war, has never mentioned the fact that, you know, fighting a war over oil when we got to keep carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere is crazy.
Well, perhaps that's what they see as the road to the diminished population. Continued fights over oil, and then one nuke after another. Should we try and lower our birth rate by encouraging folks to have only enough kids to replace themselves? I mean, isn't that the
Yeah, you know what? There. I have a double view of this. The ideal thing would be for us, our birth rate. We're averaging around 2 kids per family now. And the rest of our growth is mostly generated by immigration. But if you look at Europe, if you look at Italy and Spain and France, they're all around 1.7, 1.8 kids per family, which is where we ought to be. Now, of course, you may want to get 0.8 so you can have more presidents, but if you don't want to, it's a little hard to tell people stop at 1.8 kids.
Yeah.
So politically, I would say the proper motto is patriotic Americans stop at 2. People who care about the world their children are going to live in, not their egos and how many kids they can have, but the world their kids and grandkids will live in, will stop at 2. Ideally, I think that many people could have 3 or 4 and many others be childless. I think there's a lot of variation in how people care about children and take care of them. And, of course, what you want is the average to be about 1.8. But I think politically our motto ought to be patriotic Americans stop at 2.
Yeah, have all the really good parents have the number they want, and those that aren't good parents have fewer.
The problem is who decides.
Who decides? Politically, do you see anyone right now who might bring about the dialogue that we need to stem the population growth? Somebody who understands the points that you make in this book, who would be willing to start a serious national debate about it? And wouldn't that be a complete turnaround, since the government has, through its taxation policies, rewarded people to have lots of kids?
I think it's possible. I frankly don't know enough about Obama. I know about Obama, because I know some people who know him, is he's very, very smart. Whether or not, Al Gore's very smart, too, and Al knows all this stuff. But when he was vice president, politically his hands seemed to be tied. And, I don't know whether the president even can do this. I would have some hope that Obama would, but, it's a tough call. I think we need, first of all, people in the United States and elsewhere to start asking themselves, what are people for and what do we want? In other words, we need a groundswell of asking questions like, are we really happier today with twice the GDP that we had several decades ago? All the polls show no. When Ann and I were married 54 years ago, and I took a job at Stanford, before I went to Stanford as a postdoc, I had almost no money, and yet we were able to get along on my pathetic salary, and she could stay home with our daughter until she went to school. The daughter went to school. Now, today, virtually every professional couple I know, both people have to work to make ends meet. Is that an improvement in our lifestyle? One of the reasons I've stayed at Stanford is I can walk to my office. I hate commuting. And yet more and more people are forced to drive long distances on smoggy freeways with other people shooting at them. In other words, I think we have to ask, do we really want a country designed around cars? Do we really want everybody slaving continually to get, more video games or whatever? Or are there other things that we could do better? I mean, I would love to see the automobile converted to something that's used for family trips, maybe by several families at once during the summer, and the rest of the time for teenagers to make love in, and skip them entirely as commuting machines.
Oh, don't remind me of those teenage days. that brings me. Oh my, I shouldn't have that thought right at the moment. That brings me up to the point where I did want to mention about this. We have for so many years prided ourselves in this country and actually needed growth. And we're in a capitalistic society here where growth is very, very, very important. And if a population starts going down, where does growth end, and how do we keep our capitalistic society? I know it's an involved question, but
we've been working for 20 years. I've been working closely with economists, and now some of my closest colleagues are economists. Ken Arrow, who's a Nobel laureate, the chair of our economics department, Larry Goulder and I have been doing publishing together, and so on. And they're beginning to look at the questions of consumption and the question of, it's crystal clear to the smart ones that you can't have physical growth forever. So the issue of how you design a society that does not depend on overall growth in the amount of the physical economy is a non-trivial question, but it looks easily solvable once you get out of the mindset. In other words, it doesn't mean if you have a society in which a capitalist society in which there's competition and markets, some firms will grow and others will shrink, and there will be limits, that automatic limits put on how much raw material you can process in a given time and so on, and the smarter firms will do do better, and the less smart firms will do less well. But there are all sorts of questions of equity and social networks and so on that really have to be looked at closely, and we haven't looked closely enough at them. But that's something, again, that everybody ought to be involved in, not just economists and ecologists. What kind of a world do you want? What are you getting out of the perpetual growth? Is it the growth of the smog and the traffic on the freeways and the deterioration of our infrastructure? Or would we be better off with, less expenditures on some things and more expenditures on things that mean more to us? But I can't decide what means more to most people. Neither can you. Everybody's got to sort of get together and discuss this. And it's a discussion, as you sort of indicated, we're not having. We're worried about whether gays can get married, which to me is a preposterous question.
Well, it does seem to me that if we have reach a level where we don't have huge growth like we plan on now having all the time, that would also bring about some equity, maybe some limit the disparity between the rich and the poor.
Now, that's another huge problem of what's happening now. We have a government that is trying to convert our democracy into a corporate oligopoly. And as you know, the figures on, for example, how much a CEO makes compared to the average worker have gone through the roof. And, there are very few advantages of getting older, I can guarantee you, but I remember the 40s very well and the 50s. And we didn't have a lot of this junk, but we had perfectly happy lives. And I could give you a list of the things that really count for me and the gadgets that I would like to have. It would start probably with a refrigerator so I can have my beer cold and so on. But a lot of the stuff we have really doesn't do much for you. Not the increment that you go from no refrigerator to refrigerator, for example. Getting a new color-decorated refrigerator and replacing the old one is a very small step compared to getting your first refrigerator. And, of course, as you know, they can be built to last essentially forever.
Sure. We're talking to Paul Ehrlich. He and his wife, Anne, have written a great new book called The Dominant Animal, The Human Evolution and the Environment. And many of you do remember, because we mentioned you were going to have you on the show, many folks remember the book you wrote, the very controversial book back in 1968 called The Population Bomb. And many things that Paul wrote in that book have come to fruition, some have not. That's science, like we said earlier, but we're having Paul on today to kind of meld these two issues together. Paul, how do you feel about the biofuels? A lot of talk about that now.
Yeah, it's one of the things where most ecologists, almost all, are in total unanimity. Namely, it's basically a scam. There are a few circumstances, and maybe some more to be developed, in which you can get portable fuels from biomass, that is, from corn or from, I mean, certainly do it from corn or switchgrass or sugarcane, but you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see what's wrong with it. There's a lot wrong with it in terms of what happens to the climate and so on, but the basic thing is we're marginal with our food production now for people. And we're having lots and lots of problems in the agricultural system, and it's the single most environmentally deteriorating thing we do, although, of course, we have to do it. To switch some of that system to, instead of feeding human beings, to feeding SUVs is just plain nuts. And so, with trivial exceptions, there are places where possibly stuff that's in some sense totally waste could be used and converted to portable fuels. But doing it on anything like a scale that would change, for instance, gasoline prices is just nutty. That whole thing was started with no scientific consideration of what the consequences would be. And when people like Dave Tillman at Minnesota and others have started doing the research, seeing what happens to the flow of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, when you see what's happening to prices, when the economists look at it, we're already pushing people into starvation with that alone. And that's really, in my view, unethical and crazy.
I'm a farm boy, born and raised on, in farm country in Ohio, and we used to travel a lot when I was a kid. My father ran a big grain elevator, and every year after wheat harvest, we would head west. And we had relatives in Kansas, Atchison, Kansas, for one. And I remember the days when, during wheat harvest there, the entire streets, all the streets in downtown Atchison, Kansas, were piled high with wheat. They couldn't get it shipped out fast enough. There was huge surpluses of wheat all over the country. Even as a college kid, I had to go out and measure what they call Kennedy's acres for the subsidy program, so that we didn't grow too much. We don't have that, if you want to call it, problem anymore, do we?
No, not to the degree that we did have. And, of course, a lot of that food was shipped overseas and in some places helped a lot of hungry people. So our agricultural productivity, of course, is based on deep, rich agricultural soils, which are not as good anymore as they used to be, but it's still run, for the U.S., we have a lot of rich soil. But, of course, partly it's been kept rich with nitrogen fertilization, which creates all a long series of problems like wrecking the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah.
But I think the tragic thing is, and you're lucky, you know, if you're teaching at a place like Stanford, you understand that most people in our country, when you ask them where their food comes from, wouldn't say Atchison, Kansas. They'd say the grocery store. We had a professor in computer science who thought that milk was manufactured. One of the reasons Ann and I wrote the book is I started teaching a course on human evolution and the environment because most people going through the best university in the world came away without knowing where they came from or where they're going or where their food comes from. And it's a tragedy in our education system. I mean, you ought to be teaching kids about agriculture in the fifth and sixth grade. Probably you got that when you were a kid.
Oh, yeah.
Or you learned it on the scene.
That and on the seat of the tractor.
Exactly. But, I mean, people don't understand how much petroleum is used in producing and distributing and drying food, for example. They don't know that the food system is intimately tied in with the transport system. We did, during the nuclear winter studies, when the U.S. and the Soviet Union had tens of thousands of nuclear warheads pointed at each other, a colleague, John Holdren at Harvard, and I did a back-of-the-envelope calculation of how many Hiroshima-sized bombs, that would be the equivalent of firecrackers today, would be required to end the U.S. or the Soviet Union as a functioning country. And would you like to guess?
I have no idea.
Well, it came out to be roughly a dozen in the U.S. and maybe 10 in the Soviet Union.
And how many did we have?
Thousands and thousands. But just think about it. All you got to do in the U.S. is hit New York, Washington, Kansas City, Chicago, New Orleans, L.A., San Francisco, Portland, something like that, and you've wrecked the rail and road system. And so we have this enormous agricultural productivity, but you can't feed people. Most people don't live on the farm. You got to have the transport system working. So all you really have to do, and the Russians, it turned out, were even more centralized. They had fewer nodes you had to hit to basically wreck their ability to get food to their people.
That was one of their major problems. They couldn't get, they could raise a decent amount of grain, but they couldn't get a lot of it to where it needed to be back
then. That's right. And so, but again, in fourth and fifth grade, kids ought to be told that, you know, growing food is one thing, but you got to consider how you get the inputs to the fields and how you get the food to the people. I mean, a lot of development in places like Africa involved building farm-to-market roads. But that's the kind of thing we just don't teach most of our kids, and that's sad because agriculture is our single most important activity, and we're all dependent on it, and we all ought to know something about how it works.
Well, we don't know nearly enough. That's a certainty. The biofuels in South America, at least in Brazil, they say is making them energy independent. Not that in and of itself, because they have a recent decent find of oil offshore, I believe it is. Are they gaining a huge amount of population in Brazil? Will they be able to sustain this without cutting down a great deal more of the rainforest?
Well, that's one of the big problems. They are, of course, their population is growing, not as fast as it used to, but it's growing. And one of the things, I mean, you know, science is always uncertain, and one of the big uncertainties which makes everybody kind of nervous these days is how much of the Amazon you can cut down before the destruction continues on its own. In other words, a huge amount of the precipitation in the Amazon is generated by the forest itself. It recycles the water, basically. And if you cut down, the Amazon, at some point it will start deteriorating itself and disappear. And what we don't understand is what, for example, that might mean for climate in our Corn Belt. That is, the Amazon is big enough that it's going to affect the entire world, in all likelihood, the climate of the entire world, if the Amazon goes down the drain. So you want to try and avoid that. And, of course, we're not doing the kind of thing that would lead to avoid it. They're clearing more and more for soybeans, for cane, not just for biofuels, but for export to places like China and Japan. Mm-hmm. So it's a tough situation, and it's one where all the scientists can do is say, be cautious. If you go too far, then we've had it.
Yes. I had a question I promised somebody I would ask. It's not my question. It's somebody else's. If you, Paul, had to make a decision today on whether or not we just did away with, we were able to rid ourselves of fossil fuels right now, or lower the population, if you could wave your magic wand and lower the population down to what you think is a sustainable level, what would be your choice?
Well, I think I'd lower the population because that would give us a lot more time. In other words, if you wave away the fossil fuels, you got to substitute something for it, and that takes time. So, but of course, if you drop the population, that implies killing a lot of people. So the two are so tightly intertwined, I can't give an easy answer, but the energy problem is something that pervades every bit of the environmental situation, and so does the population problem. So the two of them are sort of, they're kind of like connected twins, and I don't see how you can deal with either one without dealing with the other.
Right.
So I'll fudge on that one and say either choice presents so many issues on the other side and on the choice itself. But the person who asked the question is a smart person, because the energy on one hand and population size on the other are the two of the most critical elements that we have to deal with. And in a sense, they're equally difficult because both of them involve everybody. Everybody uses energy, and everybody's part of the population.
If we could just get everybody to realize that.
Talking to each other and figuring out what to do.
Yes.
And there are a lot of things we could do if we had the public support behind it. And that is, people have been thinking about solutions all along. Most economists still think that gasoline is too cheap because there are so many externalities involved with the use of oil that we ought to be taxing gasoline much more heavily so that people would really think hard about having gas-guzzling cars or taking long, long trips. The argument against that is, yeah, but if you do that, you make gasoline 7 or 8 bucks a gallon, then a lot of poor people who have to drive an hour and a half to get to their job as a grocery sacker or something else are going to lose their jobs. They're not going to be able to make it. What do you do about that? And the chair of our econ department, Larry Goulder, has been working on this for years. And it's a system called tax shifting. What you do is you take the vast revenues that come in from a big gasoline tax, and you use them to pay off the FICA tax, which is a regressive tax. It hits the poor harder than it hits the rich. So you basically return the money to the poor, but not in the form of cheaper gasoline, because you want to encourage them to have the most efficient jobs and to walk to work if possible and so on. So people have been thinking about the solutions, but the trouble is that they haven't penetrated the mass media or the general public. So we're having this ridiculous argument about where we should drill for more oil when it's crystal clear, A, it wouldn't help in the current situation, and B, we shouldn't be getting more oil.
Yes. If you can indulge us for another question or two, I have
sure.
A question here from someone on our chat room. Ask Paul to talk about tropical soils leaching when the forest cover is removed. What kind of soil are we talking about, and how long does it last growing without better living through chemistry?
It's a good question. And, of course, tropical soils vary all over the place. But in a lot of the classical tropical forests, most of the nutrient is not in the soil. It's in the trees and plants themselves. There tends to be a shallow network of roots that recaptures the water that comes down and takes up the nutrients and you don't get a big nutrient buildup in the soil. So if you cut down and burn the forest, and then you get torrential rains, the nutrients tend to flush away, and you end up with very, very poor soils. One of the things that people miss in discussing the climate situation in general is that besides the right climate for crops, you got to have the right soils. For instance, people say, well, if it gets hotter in the United States, we'll just grow corn further north. Well, depends on how hot it gets, but eventually further north is in Hudson Bay, where growing corn is kind of tough, or in the Canadian Shield, where the soils are not right. And it's true if the climate changes, and, you know, in 100,000 years, the soils will change too in some places. But the question is, how do you manage to do it for the 100,000 years before the soils become suitable again?
So even in the tropical rainforest area, we're talking about trucking in mountains of fertilizer to do it there
People mistake the lushness of tropical forests for rich soils, and although there are some rich soils under some tropical forests, that's not generally the case.
Okay, excellent question. Paul, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. We could talk about this ad infinitum. It's such an interesting subject, and it's such a good book to bring people's awareness up. That's what this program's about. I'm hoping that all of our listeners will go talk about this with one of their friends tonight, and we can pass on the tremendous information you give us, the vital information. We're going to have to face this.
I think so, but it's been my great pleasure. Thank you for the time.
Paul Ehrlich and Ann Ehrlich's book, The Dominant Animal, Human Evolution and the Environment. Folks, it's a good read, and we'll be talking more about it. Paul, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Take care now.
Yeah. What a fine guest. What a knowledgeable man. Here's a man that rubs elbows with prize-winning scientists every day, with Nobel Prize people, with the staff he's with at Stanford. Here's a man that, a preeminent scientist, has certainly reminded me of some things that I needed to be reminded about our world population, and that something has to be done, and we've got to face this. And it is odd to me that we just don't talk about this issue. We don't talk about the population. We talk about going green. We talk about saving our resources. We talk about conserving our resources and all that. We don't talk, in this country very much anyway, about limiting the population. And it's fascinating to me that this is a conversation that isn't being engaged in at all in this country by any of our leaders. And like Paul mentioned, and I mentioned when we were speaking, we can face this now in a rational and logical manner, or we can face it later when the results of what we have to do then will be horrible. Famine and disease and war. That's not the way to limit the population. We're going to have to do something about it. We're going to have to engage in this dialogue, like it or not. We cannot put it off any longer. The population has exploded on this planet in the last 30 or 40 years. And we will soon see what the sustainability of life is on this planet with an optimum level of inhabitants. Will it go to 9 or 10 billion people? Will it? Hard to imagine. Hard to imagine. We are going to pause for a break right now. I think we hit the old record button on the news. So when we ran right through news time, and if Paul hadn't had time restrictions, so he would have gone on for a lot longer, and I could have talked to him a lot longer. But let's pause for news right now. A little bit late, but better late than never. And we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. 25,000 West Coast dock workers in the ILWU are taking a look now at details of the contract agreement reached between the union and the Pacific Maritime Association. They'll decide whether or not to ratify it. The union says the agreement meets the needs of workers and of the industry. Full-time, fully registered union dock workers can make more than $100,000 a year. They also have good pensions and health care benefits. Workers frustrated with the slow pace of talks had started slowing things down on the docks by taking their coffee breaks together at the same times. The Pacific Maritime Association claimed those actions cut productivity by 15% to 40%. The union says it was a message that the workers were united in seeking a good contract. Walmart managers and executives knew of widespread denial of breaks for its workers nationwide, but turned a blind eye to the practice, according to a judge quoted in the publication Arkansas Business. Megan Scott of WakeUpWalmart.com says the giant retailer faces more than 70 lawsuits nationwide for alleged labor violations.
Since 2005, they've lost all three of their wage and hour class action lawsuits that it's faced. So people are certainly becoming more and more aware of the types of irresponsible and often immoral business practices that Walmart uses in its treatment of workers.
More bad news for Starbucks workers, Jesse Russell reports.
Earlier this month, Starbucks announced plans to shutter 600 stores across the country. Those stores account for 12,000 jobs in the company. And according to Starbucks chief executive, Howard Schultz, 70% of those employees losing their jobs will be transferred to other stores. However, the company announced Tuesday that an additional 1,000 non-store jobs will be slashed, and 61 stores in Australia will be closed. Starbucks said that those new job cuts represent 15% of the non-store positions, and roughly 450 are already vacant.
Upset about a parking ticket in New York State? You better think twice before taking it out on your friendly neighborhood traffic enforcement agent. It's now a Class D felony to come into physical contact with a parking enforcer in the state of New York. Such a charge could carry up to 7 years in prison. The fight to protect traffic enforcement agents had been waged by the Communications Workers of America, Local 1182, for more than 15 years. The union represents more than 2,000 agents in New York City.
Here is today's economic report. A new study suggests that U.S. employers plan to keep giving raises in the coming year, even with the economic downturn. According to Watson Wyatt Worldwide, firms plan to offer merit increases that averaged 3.5% in 2009. However, the study also found that even with such a raise, inflation is outrunning worker pay, and that many companies aren't prepared for a total economic nosedive. 52% said they will use layoffs to cope with a substantial downturn.
For more labor news, visit laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Throw the second switch! Throw the third switch!
Not the third switch!
Throw it, I say! Throw it!
The Guy James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Fly! Fly, you hear me? In my creation! Fly!
So this was fun.
You're gonna like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Good countdown. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for staying with us during the news. Show's a little bit off schedule today because of I think that's the longest interview we ever did on the program, but I could have gone on for many hours with Paul Ehrlich. What a fascinating gentleman, and I don't know of anybody that's I'd like to get him and Al Gore in a room and just sit and talk to him about what they predict for the future in this country. Right now, we've got one of our chat room people with us. We got Bedtime for Bonzo with us. Hey, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Sweden.
Sweden.
Yeah,
well,
that's where I live.
How's the weather there?
I too followed you from the Ohio farm out to the wilds of Kansas, although not in Atchison, so I was quite pleased to hear that you got that.
Well, actually, my that particular area, Atchison, my uncle was an assistant warden at the federal prison in Leavenworth. And so he had relatives in Atchison, and we used to go over and visit and all that. We used to stop every year, and usually around just after wheat harvest in Ohio, and the wheat harvest was still going on in Kansas or just finishing, and so I know that area well.
Now, I've actually taught college courses up in Leavenworth Federal Pen, so I've been there too.
Actually, when I was a kid, people may not believe this, when I was a kid, Uncle took us out into the yard. They actually had a rock pile there. Actually busted rocks. So, anyway, well, what makes you call the show today?
Well, he's a great guest. I remember reading his books way back when. But I missed the first bit of that, and I was very interested in the idea of this connection between population growth and energy, because for every person at the state of the living in the developed world, you could support dozens in the third world at that level of energy. So population growth is intimately attached to the environment sustainability, and I suppose he got into that.
Yes, he did.
That missing the first part of the interview.
Yes, he did go into that in depth. It is inevitable. It's just absolutely inevitable. We can't sustain it the way it is now. And toward the end of the interview there, where we talked about what would you change if you could change it right now, the dependency on fossil fuels, or would you change the population down to a more manageable level? I guess he said he fudged on that. He didn't know which he would do. It is amazing how much the population has exploded, and it's been, don't you think, even you live in Sweden now, don't you think that's been kind of a silent thing that people, you know, every once in a while you read, oh, gee, there's another billion people on Earth, but...
Yeah, but in Europe, the so-called old Western Europe, now the EU, those definitions have all changed, but the population has been much more stable, and the only population growth really has been immigration.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily from the Arabic world in Africa because of the different problems there.
Yes, I've read that.
Yeah. No, but maybe 2 years ago, a very good science magazine that everybody ought to consider reading, New Scientist out of Britain, they did a study and they looked at how many equivalent planet Earths would one need if everyone were living at certain levels of living. And if everyone in the world lived like an American, an average, you would need 5 planet Earths.
Oh, wow.
To sustain that. So,
now, that's an interesting statistic.
Yeah. And the EU, even at the EU level, you would require 3. There are very few places that could be called developed that there's anything even approaching some sort of a stasis or harmony.
Wow, so, that's a fascinating thought. It really is.
Frightening thought.
Yeah. Mm.
Because it this means that this planet cannot sustain its soils, and which you know a little bit about. I studied geography once upon a time, and they're not infinite, and you can only long and so far, and their fertility will just give out. Or you have to keep fertilizing them, and that's going to give out.
Yeah,
there's a huge crunch coming unless we learn to live in entirely different ways, far less unsustainably, or cut the population.
You're right, and Paul mentioned it about the price of fuel and the amount of fossil fuels we use in farming. I don't think a lot of people understand that. One of the reasons grain prices are going up, food prices are going up, is because it takes a lot of fuel to plant your crops every year. It takes a lot of fuel to harvest the crops. But moreover, it takes a tremendous amount of fuel. I don't think a lot of people know the fact that there's petroleum products in fertilizer. When I was a kid, in a good year, we would grow 80 bushels of corn to an acre. And then up to 100. Now, I have relatives still in the farming business that farm thousands of acres that average 220 bushels to the acre. But it is better living through chemistry.
Yeah. And then if you look at, like, if you've been out the west in Kansas, see those huge center pivot irrigation they have out there. And they are pumping the aquifers dry to grow corn, which requires a huge amount of water, and that's for the feedlots and such they have in the Western Plains. And it is totally unsustainable. They have crops that are not suited for the climate, so they have to, like, this is, we're tapping fossil fuels, we're tapping fossil water.
Yeah.
And very much for something like cattle, which is a huge drain on the economy and on the planet.
I don't think a lot of people...
We're living so beyond our means in so many different ways.
Oh, absolutely. And you're right about Western Kansas. Some of the big factory farms out there, huge cattle ranches, huge.
Yeah.
I'm trying
and,
to...
Then you have something like, for those who've been out there, the Smoky Hills, the Flint Hills of Kansas, the Sand Hills of Nebraska, mm-hmm. beautiful tall grass prairie, middle-sized grass prairies. And yet they could be growing other kinds, but cattle don't do well. Buffalo do. Mm-hmm. And we should, if we were at all clever, we would reduce, and they're terrible soils for farming. They're just too, they just don't have an A horizon on them, not enough good topsoil.
Right.
So, and it's just incredible how our culture says, okay, we have to have a certain kind of cow. We have to have a certain kind of beef. Irregardless of whether the climate, the soil, the water can support it, our culture is kind of a...
Well, Paul mentioned that earlier.
On a mentality.
He mentioned that early in the interview today that we've been very successful as a species. We've done all sorts of great advancements. We've bred new kinds of grain. We've bred new kinds of animals. We've done such wonderful things. And these wonderful things are eventually going to lead to our demise. We've been successful, but ultimately we're going to be not so successful. So,
and this, so strange is that if we were to go back to some, just had a little courage to try out some new things. The Aztecs had, what was it called, amaranth, I think, which was their big food. It has huge seed heads. It used to be their porridge, their bread. Of course, it was intimately tied with their religion, so the Catholic Church at the time just wiped it out. But it would be a great crop for the Southwest U.S. It just thrives huge in the climate. But we have to have wheat. So we force that into another dry climate where it just doesn't thrive, and we have to mine water and all this other stuff. So
right.
There are alternatives, but we just don't seem to culturally be able to break the barrier.
It leads to some deep thinking, doesn't it? I don't know about you, but I like to sit back and think in an abstract way now and then. Let's suppose the population does continue to go on. Let's suppose that the natural resources that we need continue to dwindle. Where is
the level rise squeezing us on the less land? But
where will it be? Where will the point be, and how long will it be before the existence of mankind is just plain over with? Would we dwindle down to zero, or would it end with wars and famine and all that? It's
a cheery thought, yeah.
Yeah, isn't it though?
I think we're kind of seeing it already with these wars over Duff Ward and others. And these,
you bet.
There are places when you look at the news and. Well, not the American news, but you go on the internet and you can see there.
Do we have news here? I wasn't aware of that.
What's that?
You said you're not the American news. I did. I wasn't aware we had real news here anymore.
No, the little snippets of it I see are highly depressing. I sometimes have friends look at the European news, send them links, even though they can't understand it, just so they can hear the tone of voice, and it isn't just cheery blink news models singing to each other in happy little melodies. It's
not what's her name, Katie Couric in the morning. Hello,
I have
everybody.
No idea what she's like. I have not seen her, and I've been warned, don't bother.
As an anchor person on the evening news, don't bother. That's my opinion. Abysmal. Boy, I'm going to get mail for that, but I don't care. I think she's.
I might even get fan mail.
Yeah, well, that could be. Hey, thanks. Let me see. In Sweden, what is it, about 9:38 at night now, or
6 hours difference? I don't.
10:38. Okay, from where?
Yeah, it's 10. It's 10:38.
Okay.
It's finally getting dark. We're getting to that time of the year. We're past the solstice. It's a little light in the sky, so.
Yeah, you're far up north enough. I've happened one time. I took a motorcycle trip to Alaska, and I went to the movie. I was up in Dawson Creek.
That's up there, yeah.
Yeah, and I went to the movies, and I got out about midnight, and the sun was shining. And
isn't it glorious?
Yeah, it was so bizarre to me, you know. So you experience that all the time there. So.
Well, not quite. We're just enough under the polar circle or the Arctic circle that you could still read a newspaper headlines at night on a it's not quite the midnight sun. It does dip below the horizon, but it's definitely an evening thing. And of course we pay for it every Christmas when the sun is you hold your hand out on the side and it's just barely above the width of your palm above the horizon. It's up for a few hours, it gives no heat.
Oh yeah. Well, that's quite an adaptation for you from maybe not so much from the Midwest anyway, but tell me in the daytime today Fahrenheit, what would be your high temperature today?
We're having a good old fashioned carbon dioxide inspired heat wave. We're probably up to 90 this last week.
And wow!
Things are sagging. You look at the birch trees we have a lot of. They love water. They like cool. And you look at them, and the leaves are all limp.
Well, is the area equipped for that? Do many people have air conditioning?
Oh, no, nobody I know has air conditioning.
Yeah. Ooh, that'd be.
We don't normally get it this warm, but although we might.
But down to nice cool evenings then.
Sort of, but since the sun goes down late, even if it's coming in at a slant, it still keeps the temperature up.
Good. Well, I learned something today. That's interesting. Thanks. Hey, thanks so much for calling. It's great to have you listening, and I appreciate your call, and your question to Paul was very good, and we'll try and have him on again soon. And
yeah, you got pretty good guess. I'm really impressed. The one you had last night was also very good.
Yeah, we get some good ones. We're proud
of
that.
And I was also very glad to hear that John Voight has determined that even you poor Americans back home are going to be cursed with socialism, possibly
yeah.
even Swedish socialism.
Well, you know, if John Voight says so, I mean...
If John Voight says so, that you can take it right to the bank and put it in the deposit box.
Oh, man, Hollywood. Hey, thanks so much for your call. Good to hear from you.
Take care.
Yes, John Voight says we're going to turn into socialists if Barack Obama gets elected. My God, I am extremely worried about that. Extremely worried about that. So, hey, we're going to pause for a quickie break. We'll be right back.
Every vet respects John McCain's war record. It's his record in the Senate that I have a problem with. He wants us to keep spending $10 billion a month in Iraq, just like Bush. That's money we could use to build schools and roads and create needed jobs here at home. He even took sides with Bush against increasing health care benefits for veterans. People should let John McCain know. His agenda is not what we need. Not now.
listening to The Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. I'm in one of those moods today. I started off the show not in a very good mood over these McCain things, these ads of his. I'm going to be looking for more of them, though. I tell you what, as I mentioned earlier in the program, there are candidates such as Al Gore and Kerry that decided not to fight back on these things like this. I see evidence that the Obamas will fight back, and I'll tell you who else is going to fight back. The Guy James Show will kick their asses whenever we get a chance. If they deserve it, they're going to get it. And my feelings toward the McCain campaign, I didn't feel that way about it. I just thought maybe he was just another lowly candidate another pathetic Republican conservative candidate, and he is. But I didn't think he was going to come down to this. I thought maybe the 527s would and all that. But it appears he's no different than any of the others. No different at all. He's not a maverick. He's none of that. Here's a man that'll do what he has to do to become president of the United States, whatever it might be. So, all right, that's all I'm going to. Hey, how about you? I have to laugh, and I know some of you don't think it's funny, but I have to laugh every time I hear the name of Joe Lieberman. Joe Lieberman's a clown, as I know all of you know. Joe Lieberman is just a clown. He's and you all know about Reverend Hagee's comments. Absolutely fascinating how Hitler was a hunter sent by God to get the Jewish people, and that bizarre, idiotic, lunatic statement of his. And now we have Lieberman, who went to the let me see, what was this group we went to see last week about the whole blah, 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 blah. Lieberman compared Hagee to Moses at the Christians United for Israel conference last week. That's that conference of a bunch of lunatics that Hagee gets together, and they all get together and tell how the rapture is going to come, and they're going to get rid of the Jews that way and all that, although the Jews don't recognize. I mean, I'll get in trouble for saying that, but that's what they feel. It really is. And he says that Hagee's a dear friend for whom he has the greatest admiration. Yes, sir, Lieberman compared Hagee to Moses. Well, I bet that brought a standing O right there. Yes, I bet it did. Moses Lieberman. Like I said, he's a clown. I was going to talk a lot about Bill O'Reilly today. Bill, as you may know by now, went off on poor Scotty McClellan. Was it yesterday or the day before on his radio program? Just went nuts on Scotty McClellan, called him a liar, and then a demanded apology. I'm afraid McClellan was dumb enough, and you'd have to be dumb enough to fall into that trap that O'Reilly sent for him. But Bill O'Reilly, as I mentioned earlier in the program today, you give somebody some credence, you give somebody some believability when they prove to you they deserve it. And Billy O'Reilly, I mean, come on. What did I do with my notes here about Bill O'Reilly? I had some notes about Bill O'Reilly today. Who knows? I'm so unorganized here today. I got to find my note about Billy O'Reilly. I just don't want to say anything about Bill O'Reilly and not have it be right on the money, you know. Ah, here we go. In my stack about Bill O. Bill O'Reilly talking down to somebody is fascinating to me. It really is that Bill O'Reilly could get away was sitting there on his throne on Fox and demanding an apology for Scotty McClellan, for McClellan alluding to the fact that the White House talking points were given to O'Reilly. O'Reilly says that he didn't get any White House talking points. Okay? He didn't say that his producer didn't. He didn't say that his director didn't. He didn't say that his writers and his staff didn't. But I will even give O'Reilly the benefit of the doubt and say maybe he didn't get the White House talking points. I think we know that the people at Fox did. Maybe it wasn't O'Reilly. But for Bill O'Reilly to sit and pontificate to Scotty McClellan for his transgression of getting it wrong about Bill O'Reilly is really something. Really, really amazing to me that Bill O'Reilly could sit and talk to anybody like this. Bill, good old Billo, do you remember, and why don't people bring this up? Do you remember the name of Andrea Macris? Do you remember the name of Andrea Macris? The lady that made off with how many million dollars from Fox News in her lawsuit for sexual harassment from Bill O'Reilly? Why? That would be the first thing out of my mouth on a Bill O'Reilly show when he started that crap with me. If he started that crap with me, that'd be the first thing out of my mouth. Bill, who the hell are you to give any moralistic views about anything to anybody? Who are you? Bill, you have no ethics. You have no morals. You sexually harass a woman that's in your employee that can't do a thing about it, and you pay her off, and then you say, I will never speak of this again, and he hasn't, and that's it? That's how the whole matter is handled? That you, Bill O'Reilly, remain above the rest of us just because your transgressions, you say, I will never speak of this again? Does that absolve you of all of that? Does that just make it go away, that you will never speak of it again? I don't understand. I'll fight back. And I don't understand why Scott McClellan or other guests he's had on his show, when he starts in with that browbeating thing that he does with them, I don't know why they don't just shove that in his face. They couldn't edit it out, could they? Surely it would make the news. It is a live program, isn't it? So it couldn't get edited out. I don't get it. Nobody mentions it. Is it the fact that they're desperate to get back on that show again, that if they did mention it, that Fox would ban them from their network? Which would probably be the case. But, it is interesting to me. It really is. According to Macris, O'Reilly said that she should attend, She had broken up with her boyfriend. And so O'Reilly takes her to dinner. I don't know how many of you know the whole story. O'Reilly takes her to dinner. And he starts giving her advice. And he said that she should attend various charity events. Go to bars. Try and pick up 23-year-old guys. She was 33 at the time. And do what she liked, without thinking twice about the consequences. Then she alleged that O'Reilly's demeanor changed. His eyes glazed, and he began asking her humiliating sexual questions. I don't have to repeat all of them for you to get the picture. He asked her whether or not she had a vibrator. When she didn't respond, O'Reilly regaled her with a story of how he had advised another woman to purchase a vibrator, and had taught the woman how to masturbate by telling her stories over the phone. Macris said she wasn't interested, but O'Reilly persisted. He told her about a time in Bali where a short little brown woman and he had had an encounter, and that he would be pleased to tell Macris this and other stories. And I think you get the drift of O'Reilly's alleged action, but there's more. The next year, when a college friend from the U of Missouri was visiting Macris, O'Reilly joined them for dinner, suggesting a threesome, and told them that they needed to be trained so they could be equipped and ready to handle real men when he showed up in their lives. Obviously, Billow's talking about himself there. He graciously offered lessons to them. I am sure, though the complaint doesn't say so, that he would give them these lessons for free. What a guy. And the complaint went on to say, during the course of this dinner in approximately May 2003, defendant Bill O'Reilly, without solicitation or invite, regaled plaintiff and her friends with stories concerning the loss of his virginity to a girl in the car at JFK, two really wild Scandinavian airline stewardesses he'd gotten together with, and a girl at a sex show in Thailand who had shown him things in a back room that just blew his mind. Bill O'Reilly sitting telling two women this week, forcing this on them, forcing his attention on them. And then Bill told her, I would take you, if I were there, I'd take you to the shower right away. That'd be the first thing I'd do. We'd check into a room, and we would order up some room service, and you'd definitely get two wines into you as quickly as I could get into you, and I would get them into you, maybe intravenously get those glasses of wine into you. And you'd basically be in the shower, and I would come in, and I'd join you, and this was the famous part, and you'd have to have your back to me, and I would take that little loofah thing and kind of soap up your back, rub it all over you, get you relaxed, hot water. And the story goes on. This is the man who's moralizing to Scotty McClellan. You know, Bill O'Reilly is a clown. We should start a clown club on this program. I don't think anybody does that. I got to write that down. Clown club. Clown club. Yes. I need to put some attention to that. We had Joe Lieberman as a clown today. Bill O'Reilly is a clown today. I don't know which one of them's the biggest clown. And of course, Sam Brownback. Senator Sam Brownback from Kansas might be a clown of the day as well. He's all pissed off that China's going to spy on the guests while they're over there at the Olympics. Mm-hmm. Yes. He's gone crazy that the Chinese government is requiring all international hotels in China to install internet monitoring software prior to the Olympics. And so Sam Brownback doesn't like that. Why, the very nerve of the Chinese spying on people through the internet. How could they dare do that? The audacity of these people to spy on American citizens and maybe some citizens of their own. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, wait a minute. Oops. Sam Brownback voted for the FISA thing. Huh. Why would he be upset with the Chinese for spying on their people and spying on their guest, when he obviously has no problem whatsoever with the American government spying on us and any of our guests? Sam, would you care to explain that to me? I just don't get it. I really don't. What's good for the goose and all that? Article went on to say, at least in China, when they are monitoring your internet, you get a pop-up message. In the United States, the Department of Home Security just pops up at your front door. Well, well, well. The old double standard. Well, I've certainly enjoyed this program today for some reason. I hope you have as well. Certainly enjoyed my guest today. It's been a long time talking to him. As I've mentioned before, oh, I see walking into the studio right now the famous Guy James Show official mascots, Sophie and Kukla, the famous Yorkies. Kukla, so many people have asked me about these puppies. I'm going to put some up on the website. Kukla is a beautiful black with brown trim Yorkie. And Sophie is the silver Yorkie with the brown trim, kind of bronze trim. Beautiful dogs, both. And more fun than a barrel of monkeys, I guarantee you. I talk too much about them, but they are an absolute delight and a joy to have. And so we let them roam in and out of the studio when they want to. You may have even heard them bark a time or two. I heard somebody say on the chat room one day, I thought I heard a dog bark. And I know who the offending party was, sitting here right now looking at me like, hey, it's time for supper. Yeah. They do that. Do you have dogs that can tell time? Got two dogs here that can tell when it's 8 o'clock. They know it's treat time. They sure do. Anyway, thanks for being with us on the program today. I enjoyed it, and I hope you did as well. We try and have good and informative guests for you whenever we can. And don't forget, it is a listener-supported program. You can do some of that by heading on over to theguyjamesshow.com and throwing a nickel in the barrel there if you can. Thanks so much. Thanks to Billy Shears, our music director. Be sure and stay tuned. Mark will be up next. Head on Radio Network, and then Bob right after that. We got great programs all through the evening for you. Don't forget, you've heard from the Radical Right.